Welcome to the Rogue Journal Club, where we tear studies apart so you don't have to. The Rogue Journal Club is a Shio Sophia production, featuring long-form discussions of peer-reviewed studies published in academic journals and their connections to society. I'm Adrian.
And I'm Gina. We'll be your hosts.
A journal club is when academics at universities get together to talk about papers.
But we've gone rogue. We're going to do journal club our way. Join us.
We're back.
We're back
again. It's finally time for the Popper episode.
You know you've been waiting for it. Yes. Maybe you haven't been, but I have. So
I have been waiting for it because, I mean, you know much more about Karl Popper than I do.
Yeah, and you know, I'm a little off my game tonight. I mentioned this when we were off the air, but I had all these notes on the paper. I had annotated it all up. I was like all ready, and it didn't save, and I found out that at 30 minutes before we started recording. So I was not exactly going to have time to do it all over again. I think I remember some of the things, but you know, when you're in the moment and you're reading, your head is like so in it and you have like good thoughts. Yeah, it didn't, it's gone to the ether now. So sorry, folks. And I've loaned out one of my Karl Popper books that I would have pulled up. Didn't remember that either. So this is seriously for me. I'm going to definitely be like Karl Popper's three-legged bulldog tonight. So I'm limping along.
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, that happens to all of us. Like I told you that just before we recorded that, you know, I, of course, was reading this on my lunch break and didn't put any notes in a document for me to work with. So I'm going to go entirely off memory.
You know what? I mean, this is like a real life journal club because no one ever shows up prepared for those things. So I guess this is exactly how it actually is in real life. So
that is a very true statement.
You are getting the authentic experience, folks.
We aim to please. We provide you authenticity.
Yep.
All right. But before we begin, I would just put in our plug. Where is it? If I can find it. Yes, of course. Plug for a good friend here. If you're looking for some safe haven from the crazy culture that is of today, I recommend Wokescreen. As a member there myself, it's wokescreen.com/culture-warriors. Use my promo code SheoSophia for 10% off your membership. And it is all sorts of funds with lots of cultural things going on, from music to food to stained glass, which is what I do, if you can't tell from back there in the background, and all of those kinds of things alongside of, yes, we talk news and politics and science and all sorts of funky things. And we're sharing memes and we get into games nights together. So it is an awesome old time over at wokescreen.com/culture-warriors. Use my promo code SheoSophia for 10% off your membership. So, and that, back to our regularly scheduled programming. So right, let's see here. We haven't even we haven't even introduced the article yet, so we might as well go there first.
Okay. Well, you can introduce it since you sent it sort of to me. I think we both kind of found this one together, but go for it.
Yeah, we did. Well, I should go over to the other tab, but I'll go there in a second. So this is the article in question today, and it's not a research article per se, as much as it's a commentary and philosophical discussion, which is also a very good type of article. It appeared in the European Review in 2023, which is published by Cambridge University Press. The notion of truth in sciences in medicine, why it matters and why we must defend it. And the reason this came up is because this particular author, Andreas Bickfalvy, he wrote a particular piece for the Heterodox STEM Substack, which if you're not following that Substack, you should, because it's all sorts of fun heterodox thinkers in STEM talking about the Open Society and its enemies, number two. I think I sent this to you and then you found the article in question,
yeah.
I think is how that worked.
I happened to notice that he referenced his paper about this same topic.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I said, oh, look, it's in a journal. I want to see what he had to say. So I guess he did publish, a more academic version of his heterodox post in a philosophy journal.
For now.
Which is this paper right here.
Exactly. It's this paper right here.
Well, I can read that part. Why not?
Sure.
Okay. Philosophers have described several approaches for scientific research, including causal inference and induction, the hypothetico-deductive model, inference of the best explanation, Bayesianism, or causal network analysis. Prescriptive truth is dependent upon the values that one brings into scientific inquiry. One may oppose the writings of Bertrand Russell and Helen Longino. The former argues that values may negatively impact inquiry, while Longino argues that value-free research does not exist and we must cope with it. However, Longino proposes a very stringent value system which does not allow certain research to be conducted. The problem arises when prescriptive truth becomes hypertrophic, self-righteous, rigid, and unconnected to reality, which is the transformation into ideology. Ideological intrusion into science and medicine, such as with social justice ideology, is indeed a problem in Western democracies. It derived from scholarship originating in the humanities, which includes law, social sciences, branches of philosophy, etc., then transferred to science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and medicine, STEMM. I actually have a comment on that, but I'm going to say it later. The STEM field was thought to be immune to social justice because of its rigorous methodology, but the hyper-specialization and absence of training in the humanities made it vulnerable to social justice. These intrusions into STEM and the amplification in the last 2 to 3 years are potentially due to concept creep, psychogenic contamination, herd behavior, and for activists, strategical equivocation known as the Mott and Bailey fallacy. And so then the rest of the paper elaborates on all of that.
I think this second part right after the abstract is probably a quote from somebody or a couple of quotes from somebody to make some of the points that he wants to make. So like, truth and reality, science is reduced to a pointless if entertaining game, a meaningless if exacting exercise, and a destinationless if enjoyable journey. Now the characteristic doctrine of modern irrationalists, as we have seen, are emphasis on will is opposed to thought and feeling, glorification of power, belief in intuition, positing of propositions as opposed to observational and inductive testing.
Yeah, feel free to go download the paper. You can find the Heterodox blog post and then it's linked down there. And then I guess you're going to link it in the video description anyway.
Yeah,
so
I'll put them both in the video description.
Cool. So real quick, hopefully. Is anything with us ever quick? But we'll see. So adding extra letters to the STEM acronym drives me bonkers. I have nothing against medicine. I just, STEM is for science, technology, engineering, and math. And that was something that was developed by the school system to highlight which fields require the most, require quantitative reasoning. And so medicine, the parts of medicine that are quantitative are taken care of by science. And then the rest of medicine is a helping profession and requires a lot of soft skills. So tacking medicine onto the end of STEM makes it seem like we have to sort of legitimize medicine by putting it in with this STEM acronym. And STEM does not mean these are the best fields that or the only fields smart people do or anything, but I think it gets interpreted that way. Because my mom is an artist and she likes when they put an A in STEM to make it STEAM. And then you're like, okay, well, now that doesn't make any sense at all, because now this is just an acronym for everything, because it's science,
it's
technology, engineering, art and math. Like, that doesn't go there. It doesn't mean art is inferior. It just means it isn't a quantitative field. So anyway, people adding extra letters to the STEM acronym kind of drives me crazy. It's nothing really against the author's paper, but I don't know. I think we need to be mindful of the fact that the STEM acronym gets like kind of exalted on a platform that it's not intended to be like a hierarchy of careers. And I don't know. So,
no, I mean, yeah, you're right. And I've heard that before and seen that before where I've, there has been a, how should I put this? There has been for many years a sometimes unhealthy rivalry between the hard sciences, of which STEM is the hard sciences, yeah. or a lot of the hard sciences, and soft sciences are the humanities, effectively. So there's been an unhealthy rivalry with that for a long time, and it's unwarranted because they do both have their place. I know some great social scientists and I know some shitty STEM professionals and vice versa. So, you know, not one is any greater on a pedestal than the other, I don't think, at this point. Although I think some of the humanities folks would also point out that the social sciences has a problem with sincerely huge amounts of ideological bias at this point.
Yeah, so I actually will add like a one kind of minor correction is that there's the hard sciences, which is like physics, chemistry, biology.
A lot of the natural sciences too.
Biochemistry, like and the related disciplines. And then you have the social sciences, which are like psychology and sociology and political science. And then you have the humanities, which is like,
thank you. Yes.
Literature, English, philosophy falls in there, law, that kind of thing. So maybe journalism, you could even say, kind of straddles the social sciences and the humanities. So like, but it's true. I agree that those three groups of fields tend to have an unhealthy rivalry that doesn't really make any sense. And learning each other's languages and learning each other's methods is how you solve the big problems, like the big monstrous problems that we have today. Like that's what interdisciplinary science is. So
yeah,
I fully agree with you. And all of them, I think, are susceptible to social justice for different reasons. I think obviously the humanities got taken first because it's naturally a language oriented group of fields. And so social justice fixation on language is kind of a natural fit, unfortunately. Although like there are ways to do the humanities rationally, those are much less popular for some reason. I shouldn't say for some reason, it's for reasons, but we don't want to get into them right now. And then like the social sciences have a susceptibility, but his point about how STEM was thought to be immune because it's quantitative. The fact that so many scientists don't have a philosophy background, they haven't learned comparative literature, they don't know about religions and mythologies, that did make them susceptible, because when you have someone that comes up and says, well, this is all these things that we know about discrimination and all of this, they sort of assume that it came from a scientific process, and it definitely did not.
Yep.
And you have to be trained to recognize when you're hearing an ideology and when you're not. And I saw so many of my science colleagues make this error, and it was so like, rah! And that's why this author says we all need Popper, like y'all need Jesus. Well, y'all need Popper also. I'm not putting words in his mouth, but yeah, I would wear that on a shirt. I'm not putting words in his mouth, but I'm putting them in my own. So yeah, he's totally right about that. And that was one point that I really liked about, like, right off the bat reading this, I was like, that's it.
No, I agree. And it's an observation, and it made logical sense to me when I thought about it, that for one thing, you're hitting on something that I've been harping on the STEM folks for a long time, in that you didn't teach anything about the philosophy of science and why it's a good thing. So you left it to kind of fill the void. You didn't do it in the undergrad. Certainly it isn't done in high school. And then you wonder why things aren't going quite the way you think they should at this point with the STEM professions. Admittedly, not all. You do have some great STEM professors out there that are doing good things with that. But you're correct. There isn't the training of how science is done in the humanities, and recognizing some of the issues therein for most of the physical science and natural science people. Now, I'm one of the odd birds out because I do deal with interdisciplinary stuff in my professional life. So it's kind of like, I get a bunch of that all at the same time. So that's why I've been harping on some of this stuff for a while now.
And you're exposed to it through the interdisciplinary nature of the work you do. And that's how my husband ended up learning philosophy. Well, he was lucky. There was a professor in his program that actually started a philosophy club. Ooh. And so they met like, I don't know, regularly. I'm not sure how often. And they read Popper. They read all these books and they discussed, Bertrand Russell. They discussed Kant. They discussed Hume, David Hume, like all the sort of, they're not necessarily philosophers of science, Kant and Hume, but they're like the immediate predecessors, and because they cared about the state of knowledge and they cared about epistemology. So they were almost like the inspiration for some of like what Bertrand Russell and Popper did. So that's what they talked about. And so this professor must have recognized this need. And he was a cool guy, actually, that professor. And looking back, thinking like, yeah, I could see why he would have wanted to take some of these grad students like under his wing and introduce them to this. So that's how he learned about Popper. And then that's how I learned about Popper, because of my husband. So then my interest in getting into philosophy had nothing to do with the science I studied, because I was in a very kind of mainstream, safe field. It was like a very applied, like food science that doesn't really push the bounds of knowledge. It's very practical. I just learned about it because I used to be into pseudoscience, and Popper helped me learn what the real difference was between like an untested hypothesis, like a crazy idea, and pseudoscience. Because a lot of people think that just because something sounds crazy makes it pseudoscience, and that isn't true, because sometimes things that sound crazy end up actually being very robust once you put them to the test. If you haven't tested it, you can frame the question as a scientific question, or you can frame the same thing as pseudoscience. And there's hundreds of pages to read about how that works, and we'll try, I think, in this episode to like explain. But Karl Popper basically he lived and worked around the beginning of the 20th century to the 90s is when he passed away, I think. So he's recent. He essentially invented the field of philosophy of science, at least pioneered it. And his main appointment in his life was at the London School of Economics in obviously London. And so he was a little bit on the outside, like the outskirts of philosophy. He wasn't, I'm reading a book right now, which is really fascinating, called Wittgenstein's Poker. And it's about an argument that Popper had with this other philosopher, Wittgenstein. And Popper did always kind of like yearn for an appointment, a teaching assignment at Cambridge or Oxford. And he was at this London School of Economics, and a lot of his contributions had really great applications to other fields like science and economics and political science, but not so much in like philosophy proper. So he's a little bit like this kind of forgotten genius. And he also criticized psychotherapy, the Freudian style of psychotherapy, and he criticized Karl Marx. That also made him very unpopular in the academy as well. And a lot of people even today are motivated to disagree with Popper, and the reasons they propose are silly. there's a lot of attempts out there to say that Popper's been overturned, and it's simply not true. So
yeah, no, it's not true. I figured this might be a helpful bit if we're gonna introduce Popper real quick. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Karl Popper is generally regarded as one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century. He was also a social and political philosopher of considerable stature, a self-professed critical rationalist, a dedicated opponent of all forms of skepticism and relativism in science and in human affairs generally, and a committed advocate and staunch defender of the open society. One of the many remarkable features of Popper's thought is the scope of his intellectual influence. He was lauded by Bertrand Russell, taught Emir Lakatos, Firebend, and philanthropist George Soros at the London School of Economics, numbered David Miller, Joseph Agassi, Alan Musgrave, and Jeremy Shearmore amongst his research assistants, was counted by Thomas Szasz as among his foremost teachers, and had close ties with economist Friedrich Hayek and the art historian Ernst Gornbrick. Additionally, Peter Medawar, John Eccleses, and Herman Bondi are amongst the distinguished scientists who have acknowledged their intellectual indebtedness to his work, the latter declaring that, quote, there is no more to science than it is than its method, and there is no more to its method than Popper has said. Popper was born in July 28th, 1902 in Vienna. Yeah, Popper was knighted in 1965, so I think it is Sir Karl Popper is the the proper title now. Retired from the University of London in 1969, remained active as a writer, broadcaster, and lecturer until his death in 1994.
So. Yeah, he's his work. I think that's funny that that quote is like, the method of science is nothing more than what Popper has said. And, you know, that's a strong statement because there's a lot of people that think about the philosophy of science, but it really is his contribution. I mean, there are many, but you know, the main thing being falsification instead of verification is it's almost unavoidable if you try to find a way to explain science as working in some different way, you end up reasoning your way right back to falsification. For example, one of the common criticisms, or one of the common ones, is like, you know, Thomas Kuhn overturned Popper because of his theory of paradigms. And Thomas Kuhn misunderstood Popper, first of all. But secondly, Thomas Kuhn is a historian, not a philosopher, and the paradigm theory is not about the method of science, but more about like how the culture of science changes over time and how different ideas come in and out of fashion and how, you know, just how the culture reacts to new ideas and things like that, which is that book, The Structure of Scientific Revolution, is really good. But falsification is compatible with the theory of paradigms. It's not an alternative. And then the other one is that Bayes' theorem somehow, you know, is an alternative to falsification, but falsification
Bayes' theorem is actually right in line with falsification, if you think about it, because with Bayesian stats, and based on Bayes' theorem, the idea is posterior equals prior times likelihood, which was drilled into my head with my Bayesian stats class many times over, is the idea that you have an a priori thing that you think it is. You update it based upon the likelihood that you're drawing from observed data and things like that. And then you get a posterior, which is what it actually is, or as close as possible as you can get to what it actually is. But you can keep on updating that over and over and over again, which is exactly what Popper talks about in falsification.
Yeah. So it's funny, I read online, like, if you go on any forum and you look at what people say about Popper, the bias of the internet becomes very, very obvious. It's like all these sort of well actually guys that are like, well, you know, this is... So one of them was talking about, you know, how Bayesian statistics has updated or provided an alternative or something to Popper. Now, I could say updated is not a bad thing because, you know, Bayes' theorem sort of lends more discussion to where hypotheses come from in the first place, which Popper didn't really talk about at length. But you can still... This person was like, well, you just get so much data, and I guess this is sort of the AI revolution too, is you get so much data that you can keep fitting your model to it closer and closer, and you'll have so much information that eventually you have verified something to be true. You've found it to be true. And then he sort of interrupted himself and said, well, I suppose you'll never be able to get that percent all the way to zero. It was like the odds of being wrong or something. Like, that's what falsification is, bruh. It means that you can never be sure that something is true. The only knowledge that we have is what we know isn't true. So if you say, if you make a generalization, like, you know, all swans are white, this is a common one, I think, in The Logic of Scientific Discovery. That's one of Popper's books. I always forget where these different things come from, like which books they're from. But he talks about falsification kind of as, it's like a common thread throughout all the books. So, you know, all swans are white. And then you see a black swan, you now know for sure that not all swans are white, because you falsified that by seeing the black swan. But the black swan could be far, far away, and you might in your lifetime never see it. It doesn't mean that there are no, that all swans are white. It just means you haven't seen the black one yet. And so that's one thing that can be so unsettling about falsification. And I think why so many people want to be able to verify that things are true, mm-hmm. Is because it is kind of like, you know, destabilizing to think like all of the laws, the physical laws that we have, as robust as they are, as explanatory as they are, they're still tentative. They're, you know, and I guess the author of this paper actually had something where he said there's solidified truths and tentative truths. I think it's on, oh, I see it right here.
Well, I mean, we might want to yeah. start with a little bit, because we're talking about falsification and getting at the truth, but what does this author even yeah. say about the truth?
Yeah.
Might be something yeah. we can get into.
I know. I feel like I could just start foaming at the mouth with this stuff. So I will wipe my face here and just like take a deep breath. Get back to the beginning.
I really liked the introduction that he put in here, because he did give a really nice thing about the differences of certain kinds of things with regard yeah. to truth and what the definition is and all that kind of thing. So like from the introduction to the article, the notion of truth has different meanings, including factual truth, affirmation according to fact, and prescriptive truth, ethics and morals, etc. It is important for gaining knowledge, in particular in the sciences. However, this notion has become controversial. For realists, truth is a crucial element in the quest for knowledge. A realist postulates that objective reality exists and can be known, while anti-realists, for example, instrumentalists, and I would include postmodernists in that, but that's a different thing, this notion yeah. is superfluous and devoid of any use. I place myself on the side of realists and will here discuss in more detail the meaning of the notion of truth, as well as the perils that science and medicine are facing when truth is jeopardized, becoming a toy in the hands of ideologically minded social forces. The definition of truth is broad when one looks at the Merriam-Webster dictionary. The list is quite long and includes the following items: the body of real things, events, and facts, the state of being the case. That's a strange definition, but that's, leave that for a moment. A transcendent fundamental or spiritual reality, a judgment, proposition, or idea that is true or accepted as true. Hello, circular definition. The body of truth, also circular definition, the body of true statements and propositions, the property as of a statement of being in accord with fact or reality, fidelity to an original or to a standard, sincerity in action, character, and utterance, in truth, in accordance with fact. So there's a few of those definitions in Merriam-Webster that I would call circular definitions, but anyway.
Yeah. I think if you're going to go with what Popper actually says truth is, I believe it's in the Open Society where he says it in the appendix. In truth, something is true if it aligns with the facts. That's like out of the horse's mouth. So I think that very last little bit is actually what he would say truth is. Okay. Yeah.
See, when one looks at these definitions, one can distinguish what is called factual truth and what is called prescriptive and ethics-related notions of truth. Factual truth means that a statement is in accordance with the facts. Karl Popper.
Yeah.
In the empirical sciences, it means that one applies reasoning by using verification and falsification for testing hypotheses and to accept them if true or reject them if false. Truth should be provisional, which means that it can be revised. There is also solidified truth, which is more stable and may constitute a framework for inquiry. Prescriptive and ethics-related truth refers to the value context and norms imposed by society, which regulate the space in which research can be done and where it may lead. This corresponds to David Hume's what is, and what should be, ought, I shall call this Truth 1.0 is and Truth 2.0 ought. I will first briefly elaborate on Truth 1.0 and then deal more extensively with Truth 2.0. So that's what we're getting into with this article.
Yeah. I think that's interesting that people tend to use the word truth to mean belief. Mm. Like, you know, when you're in therapy, for example, therapists will say like, well, that's your truth. You know, that is
a phrase I despise, for the record, but
yeah. Yeah. And because it's what people mean when they say that is not, they don't mean that you have a different set of facts that you're operating off of. That's just a synonym for belief. That's your belief. That's your truth. That's your belief. It means the same thing. So substituting truth for belief is a big problem. And I think it changes. I think it makes, you know, whether that was an organic thing or whether it was intentional, it does kind of lay the foundation for accepting postmodernism. Because if you start calling your perceptions and opinions and beliefs truths, then it makes it very easy to just, you know, slip right into the sort of there is no objective single truth, because there is no objective single correct belief. That's true, but there is an objective truth. It may be very difficult to know perfectly, probably impossible to know perfectly, but it's there. This is a premise that you accept when you are a philosopher of science or a scientist. By virtue of doing the work that you do, you accept the premise that there's an objective truth to know. So,
or you would hope that folks do, because there's, of course, things that are going wrong. And again, I go back to, why aren't we teaching some of this philosophy to our next generation of scientists? Like I said, I didn't learn too much about all of this stuff until 5 years after getting my PhD. So
yeah, it's a little unsettling. It's very unsettling, in fact. Not a little, a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I was always doing it intuitively, because you're doing it as part of your work, particularly if you're being taught the practice of science. Even if you're not taught some of the philosophical underpinnings, you're learning how to do it regardless, and you're learning some of the philosophical practicing of it without necessarily being taught, you know, exactly what it is and why it came up that way and why is it important and all that kind of jazz, all of which we actually should be teaching our next generation of scientists. This has kind of been my bone to pick with on that. Maybe something I try and create somewhere in my life is a philosophy of science course. That would be a lovely thing to create.
We talked about doing that with woke screens. So if you out there in the listening audience think that sounds like something you would like, leave us a comment, let us know, because we have talked about,
I want to make it anyway.
Setting one of those up.
I want to make it anyway. So what I was going to say is you're so right in being open to postmodernism. If you think like it's all just relative and what have you, and we think of critical theory and critical constructivism in particular, you have the whole notion that everything is a social construct. Everything's constructed by somebody. And oftentimes, if you're looking at it in the postmodernist thought, it's constructed by whomever is creating the dominant narrative and people in power and all that jazz, because it's more about power than it is about truth and all that kind of jazz. But if you think about how upending that is and how much anarchy that causes, in a way, with the whole notion of everything being socially constructed, well, I could argue that, well, it's that climate change is just a social construction of the dominant people in power. It's not real. You see where stuff gets really weird? And that point when you start arguing that everything is a social construct.
Yeah. I mean, people do argue all sorts of things are imposed by language. Or, and you know, what's kind of funny about that phrase, a social construct, is that's really misunderstood too, because gender is a social construct. The concept of gender is a social construct by definition. It doesn't mean what a lot of other people seem to think it means. There's a lot of things that are social constructs because they're concepts that we made up to describe aspects of reality. So, that's what that actually means. And I think maybe it was undergraduates or activists or people just like you know, like the game of telephone where, you know, things get diluted as more people share them with others. I don't know, but somehow it's confusing the object for its reference. Yeah. You know, it's like something that people do. We all do it because you develop these constructs to make explaining reality easier. And then the construct itself kind of takes on a life of its own. It becomes something tangible.
Yeah.
And so then it's easy to be like, oh, maybe everything is made of language. Like, but it's not, because if it was, then the bridges
wouldn't
fall
actually
down
exist at all. And we wouldn't be able to give anything to it.
Yeah, I mean, if everything was subjective, then the airplanes would fall out of the sky and bridges would collapse and medicine wouldn't work and you and I couldn't be having this conversation. Like, the reason why everything in the modern world exists is because there's like coherence between, you know, perceptions that we are able to measure with instruments. So
all of us,
whatever,
with our multiple senses and all the things that we can instrument, you know, we can have three different people put out the same instrument or be in the same place and all this other kind of stuff and get toward the same, see the same things, even if you even give it names or if experience the same things, but if you may give it a name that's different, is all that really is. And it's like, you may think the room is hot, I may think the room is cold. What does that thermometer say?
Exactly. Yeah. So, and we can put that thermometer in many places and it will read like many places in the room, and it will more or less read the same temperature, but then if you get further enough away, and then, you know, it gets complicated from there. Those are not reasons to overturn the idea of objective reality. Those are just variations of reality. Like, you can't really convince, you know, there's a YouTube video out there that I remember watching years ago because I was looking for like something, I forget what it was, to explain. I don't remember what I was trying to explain, but it was this person explaining that because of the existence of colorblind people, the color of the sky is subjective. And I was like, are you effing kidding me? Like, this is, you know, and the video has lots and lots of views and, you know, people seem to think it's this great educational video. And I was just like, really?
It's not so, an educational video. Oh my
yeah.
God.
No. Educational of something, but no.
It
was educational
about
for
how
me.
Dumb some things on the internet can be.
Yeah. Yeah, it was highly educational for me. I was like, wow, today I learned people think this.
Well, so, I mean, we do still technically have flat earthers, so
we do. I'm personally a triangular earther.
Oh, really?
Personally, yeah. I mean, evidence against the flat earth is if the earth was flat, the cats would have pushed everything off the edge by now. I wish I could take credit for that, but it's not mine. I think it came from Reddit, if I'm honest, but it's great. Yeah.
Okay. So let's see here. Truth 1.0 is about the observation experimentation kind of things, which I think we kind of been hitting on somewhat indirectly already. So we don't necessarily need to go too much into that other than it was like, he's talking about different data driven ways of doing research and things like that. And so it's,
yeah.
It's a relatively short section because that's the well-known part of doing science, right? Is the observational and data-driven kinds of things that we have to deal with.
Like, and his point that Thomas Kuhn, who I talked about a couple minutes ago, the paradigm theory, the structure of scientific revolutions book, he said Thomas Kuhn formulated the concept of paradigm and scientific revolution, but he ultimately had a relativistic outlook since he did not hierarchize between more recent, better knowledge, which is closer to the truth, and older knowledge that has been upset by the new knowledge. I think that's interesting. I never really thought about Kuhn's theory of paradigm as being relativistic, and I have to read that book more carefully. I have like flipped through it, but I haven't actually read it. So I have it here on my shelf and I probably should just like get into it because I want to be able to intelligently comment on Kuhn. But, you know, I can't exactly. But that's interesting. Relativism is really, really appealing. And I do wonder if secularism, you know, is one of the reasons why relativism is so attractive to the academy. And I don't, and I say this as an atheist.
Yeah. Well,
so it's, I don't know the reason, but yeah.
I mean, you'd think it would be attractive because one of the things with relativism is the notion that there's no culture that's better than any other.
Right.
They're all similar. They're all on a pedestal and reasonable people can disagree very much on that one. And reasonable people have disagreed. That's not the point here right now, but
yeah,
I think that's what you're getting at is that notion that if it is somewhat relativistic, then it makes all the more case for a certain degree of equity that you shouldn't have different outcomes necessarily if all these, if all things are the same.
Yeah. I think it's like, if we don't compare, then we never have to see differences. And then the differences never get pointed out. And then the groups that may come out on the losing end of whatever that comparison is will not be negatively impacted. And it's not like that isn't true. But, and you can learn about cultures by studying them for their own sake within themselves and not comparing. Yeah. You can compare and you cannot compare and you'll learn different things. Like that ultimately is what, you know, the good humanities people, like the talented ones do, is they are able to compare and not compare and learn a robust set of information. And it's, it is when you say no culture is better than the other, based on what characteristics, because there are some things you can learn from other cultures that are better than, you know, but then the concept of better is something that you could debate forever. Yeah.
Better
forever.
And better at what?
Better
and better at what is another thing. So it's,
I mean, this is like one of the things philosophers debate forever is what is good. And there's books written about just that alone. So, you know,
and that gets us to the moral and value laden parts of this thing. That is the sort of truth 2.0 here, which is the more interesting conversation. I'm just thinking, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to, we wanted to hit on truth 1.0 before we go on to the 2.0.
Well, I had a whole bunch of notes and I don't now. So there might very well have been some things that I wanted to say about that. I think that was possibly
this is why we have the shirt today. Houston, we have a problem. We had technical difficulties. We had all sorts of oddities happen today.
I know.
And that happens.
I have like cameras and mics everywhere. I'm like kind of playing with all my toys tonight. So we had to troubleshoot all of my wires and various pieces of technology. Hopefully it all works. I guess we'll find out when we're done with the recording.
That we will.
Yeah. So truth 2.0, like the truth 1.0 section was pretty short. And I think it's pretty straightforward as to what that means. So I'll read this one paragraph real quick. So it's a number of ways. So how do we get knowledge? I think it's important to explain real quick the just that, because I think that's what we're really interested in is how do we know things? That's why we care about philosophy of science on this show and why everybody should care. So a number of ways have been described by philosophers of science for gaining knowledge and ultimately truth, in quotes. These include classical causal inference, induction, Bayesian statistics, error statistical approach, inference to the best explanation, and causal network building. And so he's not going to elaborate on all of that, but I'm just throwing that out there because the author also says you can refer to existing literature if you want to read more about what that is. So that whole section is really just like, how do we know stuff? Truth 1.0, very straightforward. The truth 2.0 is, I think, where we run into trouble and why I think I'm personally opposed to even calling that any kind of truth and calling that belief.
Yeah, I had a problem with that statement of truth 2.0 also, although, you know, there would be and there is reasoned arguments to be made for their for moral and ethical truths. sure. that we embrace in society under the Overton window, which I think he goes on about the Overton window at some point, but yeah, there's a difference between the factual observation of things in Truth 1.0 and the belief systems that people have, which, again, I mostly agree with you that I don't think that that's necessarily truth or truth 2.0 per se. Although I think that may be why he built this in here, because it's in this section that he goes into the social justice ideology stuff too. So that may be the reason why he phrased it like that.
Yeah.
But whoops, I'm in the wrong place. There we go.
Yeah, this first section, I think I do remember what one of my points was. So he's contrasting value-free and value-laden science. And I'll read that part. So there's two positions which seem antagonistic, one in favor of value-free inquiry and the other in favor of value-laden inquiry. It is, of course, evident that a physician and biomedical researcher, for example, must have a personal minimal ethical framework, which for physicians is represented by the Hippocratic Oath. Bertrand Russell has argued that, right. Bertrand Russell has argued that philosophical or scientific, as the author of this paper adds, inquiry must stay value-free, and that introducing personal beliefs has and will harm the enterprise. More recently, the value-laden viewpoint has gained prominence. In particular, philosopher Helen Longino in 1990 has argued that value-free science is a myth and that belief and assumptions guide research. So my opinion on that is that the false dichotomy, I think you can't actually avoid all values, but that is the beauty of the scientific community and why you need viewpoint diversity, because that is how you keep checking against biases that come from science that has value in it. Mm-hmm. Because scientists are human, they're going to come in and develop hypotheses based on their personal values. There's no way to remove that, but you do the best you can with the methods.
And I go back to the In Defense of Merit paper with this, because they talked about that, and not so much under the value side of thing, although it's the natural extension to that, where you go from values to you get to the political aspect and the politicization of things. And that's the thing. I still don't know of anybody who has argued, particularly in recent memory, that is defending merit and the notions of objective reality and particularly the scientific method and process. I don't know of any of them who have argued that scientists are perfectly objective all the time, people right. and not subject to any cognitive bias or any of those kinds of things. But that is the beauty of doing it as a community, whether we recognize it or not. Science is a collective enterprise. It is not just one person slaving away in a corner somewhere. Never has been, really. There's a lot of myths around that, like Albert Einstein and things like that. He was just twiddling away doing whatever. Well, no, he wasn't by himself necessarily doing that. And so that you need that collective body of folks doing that, because then you do check and challenge each other's biases. You can engage in multiple attempts at falsification with things from very different perspectives and methods of looking at a problem.
And challenge
each other's biases. So
in a sense, I agree with Helen Longino that value-free science is a myth. It because humans do science. So of course there's going to be values in there. But
see, here's where I would put a nuance on that.
Yeah.
Science may itself be value-free, because science itself is not a person. It is a process by which you get at the truth, right?
Yes.
But scientists themselves are human, so no, they can't be perfectly value-free in all of this, which is some of the reasons why we've needed, like, the ethical guardrails that we have for medical research and for human subjects research, because we realized real quick that when we didn't have ethical guardrails, like in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, you had some pretty damn horrific things that happened in the pursuit of science, or maybe science in quotes, because you had a lot of ideologically driven crap that was going on at that time too.
Yep. I think maybe what your point just made me think is that when some people say science, they mean the content of science, such as the conclusions, the hypotheses, the subject matter, versus the method. So the process and the method of science is value-free, but the conclusions, the hypotheses, the experimental designs, like the specific content, the substance of any specific scientific study or topic, is going to have some values in it because it was thought of by a person. Like, where do our hypotheses come from? Like, what makes us interested in asking a certain question? That's not always a completely kind of like mechanical. There is some subjectivity into what we choose to study, but the way that we study it is going to be value free because it's a method. And we in theory, are going to apply that method over and over consistently, which, you know, we don't even always do. So,
or you could take it another way, as value free as it could possibly be, knowing that it is humans doing it, or not value free at all, in the sense that the one thing that all scientists value, and I'll come back to that in a second, that all scientists value is what the truth is. And figuring that out, despite the fact that they may have completely different competing values on other things, that is one thing that a lot of scientists share in common. And the reason I wanted to come back to it is because as you have an ideological creep, you have less scientists and more scientists, in air quotes, or activists masquerading as scientists, which is something I think both of us despise.
Where it's not so much science as scientism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or even just some kind of ideology pretending to be science, because scientism is more so the irrational belief that science could solve everything.
Right. Yeah. And the paper that we're going to talk about on our next episode is a really good example to me of that. So that will be fun. Join us for that. We won't give away any of the secret. So you'll just have to be surprised. All right. So yeah, moving on. Contextual empiricism is what this Helen Longino person came up with to stress the presence of value, context, or framework. So, I mean, it's funny because I think that even still, there's going to be a value framework that informs what any one individual scientist is going to choose to study. Like, I was interested in studying a certain thing because of personal experiences I had in my life that made me curious about these questions about food and things like that. But it's not, it doesn't mean that, like, you know, all of my research was biased, toward or against any particular thing that had to do with my personal, my personal beliefs, because, like, there's instruments and, you know, you plate bacteria and they grow. Like, my belief about what food is healthy to eat has no bearing on that. Like, you know, unless you're like really kooky and you believe in things like, you know, the mind can, like, some kind of magical, don't even go there. Like, that's a separate conversation that shouldn't, it's crazy. So I shouldn't say that, but it is crazy. Based on my past experiences, I've allowed myself to say that certain things are crazy. But, like, yeah, so I forgot where I was going with that because I got sidetracked by talking about magic.
No, I mean, I think Longino argued at some point that, you know, the scientific methodology should not be allowing for certain kinds of research that could potentially harm minority groups and all that. Right. And this author, I can't pronounce his name, so he might get called this author several times, but apologies to the author. I just can't pronounce your name right now. Because he argues it's problematic because, you know, is the range of ideas that the public is willing to consider and accept, but which may shift or be extended as the value system of society changes. This window may shift and what was not problematic will become problematic. And then second, who is imposing these values? When one looks at historical events, value systems may vary enormously and may have some good, but also some very negative impacts on research, i.e. ideologically driven value systems such as Nazism or in Soviet communism. I do believe that should be capitalized, but anyway, Furthermore, value-bound research impedes the autocorrective mechanisms that are built into science when science is done freely. Science that promotes racism can be easily debunked with better and freer science. And indeed, that's happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too with, like, you know, one of the things that I have read in some of the more extreme social justice papers is that the theory of evolution promotes racism, so they're not going to appeal to it. Well, the racist interpretations of evolution were incorrect interpretations of evolution, and that's very easy to show. So it doesn't mean we throw out evolution. It means we stop interpreting it in a racist way. So
exactly.
Exactly.
That's exactly the case. But yeah. So that's the is and ought. Bick Falvey. Thank you. That's the guy's name. Bick Falvey. I just didn't want to try and pronounce it when I didn't have his name in front of me.
Yeah.
So because he gives some examples then of some historical examples against Longino's value-laden science concept, which, you know, it's not perfectly, we've already talked about this, it's not perfectly value-free. It can't be. But that doesn't mean it's, like, driven from the top down with exactly all these different values either. And, you know, actually, I don't think I have the book here, but the prime example that comes to mind when I think of it is Spencer Wirt is a great historian in the climate science world. And so he's written books about history of climate science and how it's developed. And I want to say it's the book, The Discovery of Global Warming, I think is the title of the book. But he talks over all of the history and the major things that have happened. And the consistent theme that I got when I read that was, you know, there was a lot of things going on at the time where it was presumed that there's no way in creation that humans could have any large-scale influence on the climate or anything like that, you know. But what you found was that was a lot of the climatologists of the time saying that. But what came out that ended up all those findings that eventually, you know, disproved that notion, or shall we say updated our understanding, as it were, to be somewhat Popper-esque here. Those came from folks who were not traditionally climatologists. They were in very many other different fields at the time. And so, like, yeah, you could have some groups that have very strong beliefs that something is, and therefore they're not going to look at it. But so long as you allow science to be done freely, you could have somebody else come at it from a completely different perspective and overcome those sort of values laden things of the traditional discipline. So there's a historical example with that. So it's not that it's entirely value free. It can't never be, but even when it is really values laden, that can be overcome.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think his example of Semmelweis, the person who washed their hands in the delivery room, that guy, I think that was his claim to fame. He was at odds with the explanation of childbed fever of his time. He broke with the current theories of his time by applying the scientific method through experiment. So that's actually a really good example of how an untested, wild, and potentially weird sounding hypothesis can be science if it is subjected to falsification. And if there is, I think one of the ways that you can tell that something is pseudoscience, which I believe encompasses conspiracy theories and the paranormal and, you know, other sorts of what people refer to as woo, that if you ask the person purveying, like kind of pushing the idea, you know, what kinds of things would you see that would convince you that you're wrong? If they don't have an answer for that, then you're probably dealing with pseudoscience. And a conspiracy theory can be science if you test it, if there is a way that you could be wrong, because conspiracies do happen. But lots of conspiracy theories are pseudoscience because the person is not willing to actually subject it to falsification. So this is like the thing.
Falsification, they explain it away.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the beauty of Karl Popper is, like, It's like your scam detector. To me, that's what it is. It's like my little boop, boop. I can detect now when I wasn't able to when I was younger. And now I have a better ability to do that. When I'm coming up on an ideology or pseudoscience or something like to that effect, yeah. and I can stop and say, okay, I don't know everything about this field that I'm being presented with. We can't all be experts in everything, but if the person is unwilling to offer ways that they could be wrong, that's at the very least a red flag. And mm-hmm. so for those of you out there that are wondering, what the hell can I even do with this Popperian rationality stuff? That's the thing that you can do. If you are, you know, high school educated, if you are 10 years old, like you can do that. You can do that at the bare minimum. You can do that.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
But now we get to the fun part with this particular paper that I think we've been itching to get into, and we've been kind of dancing around it a little bit. But I love
dancing
the way this
fun.
Dancing is fun.
Yeah. Okay. So, go for it.
Yeah. A problem arises when value systems become hypertrophic, rigid, self-righteous, and do not relate to objective reality. See figure one. Science then becomes a toy in the hands of ideologues, and this will have dramatic consequences for scientific inquiry and science in general, such as Lysenkoism and famine in the USSR, etc. Hypertrophic, not reality-bound value systems are not only a problem in authoritarian countries, but also in Western democracies. And this is, I love this paragraph, to be honest, because it's it's a nice layout of what the big problem is, because having values is not itself bad. It's when you do not tether them to reality and your narrative matters uber alles. Which is why I go back to the thing of, I don't like activists masquerading as scientists, because it tells me they're not interested in the truth at all. They are interested in preserving and promoting their particular preferred narrative, even if it is extremely wrong.
I think the relativistic, I guess the not the the relativistic non-realist aspects of social justice are the parts that I obviously don't like. I'm actually quite sympathetic to marginalized groups, to use their language. And there's certainly legitimate grievances that certain groups have with the past, obviously. But I think there are Popperian rationality, falsification-based ways of dealing with all those issues. And that's really where, like, I try to be really as like sort of balanced and true to my actual views as I can on this show. And I do have a lot of liberal views still. And it's just that when the left broke with realism and rationality, if they ever were connected to it, no ideology really is. Like, the right has its own kind of issue.
The right has its crazy people too.
Yeah. I mean, once you break into ideology at all, you start breaking away from realism and rationality, and that's the danger zone. And I think Karl Popper knew that, because, and I mentioned this when we were off the air, this book that I'm reading, Wittgenstein's Poker, it kind of goes through the life history of Karl Popper and Wittgenstein too. Popper lost 16 family members in the Holocaust. And so this is his, the open society and its enemies, I think, was very personal. He never mentions Hitler by name in the entire book, but you can very much tell, because of when it was published and just the tone that certain things he says take on, that, like, you have to see that he's talking exactly about that. So, you know, he saw firsthand the problem with ideology. And I think that was his, you know, that was, you know, for lack of a better word, those were his values that he took into his work. So, so he's bringing that in. That was what made him interested in thinking about all of this in the first place. So, ideology. No. Yeah.
And I mean, that's the point where we find ourselves in, because, I mean, I've harped on this a few times, and you and I have both harped on this a few times, that the greatest ills out of science that folks can and do have grievances with, and I can understand having grievances with them, have happened in history when ideology has trumped that pursuit of the truth. Lysenkoism being easily the primest example of it, because, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. What can you explain Lysenkoism? I only have a really foggy understanding of it. I think it's his misunderstanding of evolution. That's all I really know. And it was related to crops. That's all I know.
Yeah. So yeah, Lysenkoism is named for Trofim Lysenko, who was a agronomist and geneticist in the Soviet Union. Poorly trained, as Anna Krylov would tell you that one, because she's written up a great piece on that too. And he basically, like, if there's two figures I contrast in history, it's Trofim Lysenko and Thomas Sowell, because they took very opposite trajectories from each other. Trofim Lysenko was technically trained as a scientist, yes, but he became so engrossed in the ideology of Marxism, socialism, and ultimately, of course, communism, that he was willing to throw all of that out, all of that understanding and pursuit of the truth out, falsification and what have you, because it was Western science, or bourgeois science, as it were. And so that's what happened with him. Gregor Mendel's genetics had been around for about 100 years by that point already, and it was fairly well established. It had falsified, or it was believed to have falsified, the notion of Lamarckian genetics, which is basically, in a sense, that you can teach a generation of plants by exposing it to something, and it will retain that through the generations.
Yikes.
Yeah. But what happened with Trofim Lysenko is he embraced that, because Lamarckian was very much in line with the Marxist notion of materialism, there, and that everything is determined by your surroundings, not there's nothing internal to you, that kind of thing. And he embraced that to a degree where he made promises to Joseph Stalin that if, you know, you start planting wheat in the winter, it's going to retain that knowledge and pass it on to the next generation of wheat, so that you can just keep on growing all the time, all year round. And that way you could end this famine that you have.
Yeah.
You can end the starvation that you have. Obviously, because it was very much beloved. And I could have some of the details wrong. I apologize for those of you watching. And it is a tough one to get your head around what was going on with it. But in either case, the whole notion of Trofim Lysenko had with genetics got him into Joseph Stalin's good graces. And because it got him into Joseph Stalin's good graces, Stalin named him the head of all science in the USSR, which, because of the USSR being what it was, where if you disagreed with the party, you were in serious trouble, that ended up resulting in a couple of things happening. The first is, for other scientists, agronomists, geneticists, what have you, who disagreed with Trofim Lysenko, you ended up with basically three choices. You recant, you sit in prison for a little while, or you're dead. Or you run, for that matter. You could run away from the USSR. That was the kind of thing that happened. That's why science in Russia went so far backward during the time of the Soviet Union, is they allowed for absolutely no dissent. The other thing that happened, of course, is what makes Lysenko considered to be probably the greatest mass murderer in history through his ideas, is the giant famine in the USSR that followed, because of course his ideas were wrong.
Yeah, talk about falsification. Jeez. Yeah.
His ideas were very wrong. That was the great famine in what is today known as Ukraine. As well as a couple of other parts. And it didn't end there, because of course when Mao Zedong came to power in China, he took up Trofim Lysenko's ideas during his whole rise to power and caused millions more deaths in China.
So that didn't necessarily so much verify Mendelian genetics as it falsified Lamarckian genetics.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah,
that was the whole thing there. But that's why. But the reason that all came about was because Lysenko was so devoted to ideology. And I mentioned Thomas Sowell before. The reason I contrast him and Lysenko is Thomas Sowell is the dead-on opposite of Lysenko. Thomas Sowell started his time as a committed Marxist, and he has gone on to say in works following that, you know, the reason he's no longer a Marxist is because facts.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could be a rational Marxist and because I've met those, like a classical Marxist who's not a non-realist. So they exist. But yeah, I mean, your point remains. I mean, yeah. So actually what's interesting about the Open Society and Popper was that he didn't even necessarily have a lot of bad things to say about Karl Marx, in that he said he had a prophecy that the end of history would come when there was an uprising of the proletariat and the workers would take back the means of production. That was a prophecy. It was for lack of a better word, it was a hypothesis. And Popper says that essentially Marx was falsified in how things turned out. And then some people don't agree that Marx was falsified by that. And we could discuss that, but that's a different episode and we're already way over an hour. So I won't, but but yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that he was saying, was like, you know, that's a fair thing to wonder. You know, 19th century capitalism was pretty terrible. And if you looked at the working conditions of the time, you would say, okay, yeah, maybe the workers are going to get so mad that they're going to rise up and, you know, something, there will be a revolution. You know, who knows what that will entail, but it will eventually lead to, you know, the end of history and the paradise or something like that. I mean, it sounds kooky, but that's only because we know that it didn't work out that way. How would you know, you know, given what you were observing at the time that Marx lived? So you can be a rational Marxist, but a lot of them tend not to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you take Marxism to its extreme, as you do with a lot of philosophies, you end up with things that just don't map onto reality.
Yeah. He has, in moving forward to the rest of this section, he has this section where he like actually, I guess he reprints a diversity statement where the authors of some paper that he found.
Oh yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Where they were committed to, and they gave like the relative, like they did an analysis on their reference list of whether like it was male or female. Now, we're not talking about the actual substance of whatever their research was. They're talking about like the gender balance of the papers they cited in their reference list, which is like, I don't know, man. This is a waste of time. This is a waste of resources. I never even really think about the names of the people who I cite. I just look at what the paper said. I don't even think about it.
And that's exactly the thing. Like this kind of thing is a blatant violation of the universalism norm, the Mertonian norms is what I'm thinking of, because you're giving a damn about what the guy looks like, or a girl or whomever it is looks like. But like I've said it before, when I've done peer reviews, there's only two times that I ever look at a person's name. One is just to make sure I don't have a conflict of interest in reviewing the article. Like, did I write something with somebody a while back? And the other one is when I'm putting the names on the review. It's the only time I ever look.
And, you know, to
and
be
the
honest,
reason I don't look is because it doesn't matter. The person's name actually doesn't matter as much as their ideas. And a lot of this kind of stuff is about ideology more so than it is about any kind of falsification. Because I don't know, there's a lot of the postmodernist stuff, and they talk about this in the book Cynical Theories quite a lot when they go into all of these kinds of background things that we're talking about here, and that I think are up, they actually have it up here further, because, you know, cultural Marxism with critical theory, not just critical race theory, there's a whole bunch of other critical theories, but, you know, postmodernism with Foucault and Derrida, I would put Paulo Freire in there too, but anyway. And those kinds of things all getting thrown into it here, but none of them do any falsification. None of them do any of that. None of them are actually interested in that. And I've said this before, when you read the postmodernist literature, they're more so interested about who's got power at any given moment. And, you know, sort of upending that based upon who has power and who doesn't. And this is where you take the, you know, the argument of privileged and marginalized to its nth degree extremes. You gotta correct these. You gotta absolutely correct these things. Whether or not it's true is a different question. you know, and a question yeah. that a lot of postmodernist thought is openly hostile to at times, if not just, you know, yeah. outright. And, you know, as we're recording this today, I recorded a different piece last night, actually, that I think is going up tomorrow at the time of this recording. So it'll be well after this is, it'll be up well before this is out and published. But it was one of the things I talked about in there with regards to the things going on campuses the last couple of weeks. And basically, how do you have a discussion when you don't share one fundamental value in particular, i.e. if one group is about truth seeking, but the other group is not, how do you even have that discussion?
Yeah, you can't. It's like you're speaking two different, I don't even know if you can even make that, if it's a two different languages. I don't even know what that is. You're just like, it's not going to happen.
I said it before, and it is true. Many scientists do share one common value in that we're after what the truth is, regardless of what our reasons are for studying it. We're after what the truth is. That's not true yeah. of activists, and that's not true of ideologues.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is this, like, the activist. So one of the things that Popper was really against in the Open Society in particular was oracular philosophy. And I think he coined that term. I don't think that's like what it's called in philosophy, but that was just his way of describing it. That it was like the methods of Hegel that sort of inspired this lineage of philosophers that just like make claims like that are like you're an oracle, like that they're inspired, and that you're the idea is delivered through you. Now, interestingly, so the author of the paper says, there are statements such as the story of science as an objective hunt for inalienable truth performed by lone genius white men has pernicious effects for many efforts exist already to, okay. So they don't like the lone genius narrative, but they like oracular philosophy, which is really a lone genius narrative, you know, on its own. So it's this idea that you have this lone genius who's like an oracle of some idea, and they're a medium through which the ideas come, and they say it, and it's what it is. That if you don't like the lone genius narrative, then that is a form of that. So it's just very revealing that, you know, every time you look at an ideology and you dig into it, you find that it's like riddled with internal inconsistencies, because it really, being logical and being truthful and being consistent and rational is not the priority of an ideology. It's to maintain a certain desired endpoint or whatever the point of the ideology is, which in the case of social justice, it's the endpoint is perfect equity, you know, and that's really what they're after. Mm-hmm. So they'll throw rationality under the bus because they're after equity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the narrative uber always. And I'm actually going to turn off my camera real quick because for the next section, I want to grab a prop that's behind me here. So I don't want to get a up prop. On camera.
This is exciting. We haven't had a prop in our show before. Go for it.
Be right back. So yes, there's this thing I wanted to grab because the section that we're in, they're talking about issues with publishing, right? You know, social justice ideology and science publishing with like special issues on racism in Nature, which I remember reading that and I was like, oh dear, fuck. Those kinds of things. And, you know, talking about Nature in its introductory page, we're all accustomed to the Nova Lingua of social justice in light of many previously published articles by the same journal. In their own words, Nature has played a part in creating this racist legacy. After the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Nature committed to becoming an agent of change and helping to end discriminatory practices and systemic racism. Not only deals with self-accusations of deeds of the past, but also of the present. Without specifying any of the present-day racist articles they published, it is egregious self-loathing. Now, the reason I wanted to go grab a prop real quick is because they are not the only one. I held on to this when I picked it up in an airport a couple of years back, And it's an article. It's a magazine of Scientific American, which is now well over 150 years old, as it were, and have really gone down the drain. It was one of the videos I did recently was on the fall of Scientific American, because somebody did a great job of documenting how they kind of collapsed under the weight of ideology. And that's because they published this whole special issue thing of Science for Social Justice. I forget exactly the issue number, but this is the published version that was in the airport. Because, of course, they do a full publication magazine style that you can find if you're going through shops in the airport and all that kind of jazz. So, like, what is this? Oh, where is it? Spring, summer 2022. That's what this one is. Their spring, summer issue of 2022. But it includes things like, hang on a sec. So at the time, you had a lot of things against critical race theory in the news. So they have a whole opinion on that. Disinformation campaign, the election of anti-CRT candidates demonstrates how exploiting white fear continues to galvanize voters. That was in Scientific American, mind you. How to think about implicit bias, death by a thousand cuts. All of those kinds of things. Where is it?
Well, Scientific American is journalism. So journalism is all susceptible to this because they operate on the principle of verification, and it's in their textbooks. And now that you guys know what falsification is, hopefully you can kind of tell why journalism, magazine journalism, newspaper journalism, online TV journalism, it's all the same. You can create a false story by weaving together a bunch of true facts. And journalism is very, very good at that because you can verify that so-and-so said this quote. You can verify that, you know, this particular viewpoint exists or this event occurred. And you can piece together a narrative based on facts that is ultimately false in what it's conveyed.
I gotta make my hand off of it.
So those are the dangers of verification over falsification. So what does that say there? Sorry.
It was the final section of this magazine. There was a lot in here. The fifth and final section in here, making a more equitable world with all of its fun stuff in here. I mean, don't get me wrong. Yeah. Beautifully designed, very colorful, but this is all ideologically driven.
Yeah. Well, that just goes to show you what I said.
The reason I wanted to highlight that in lieu of this kind of section was because, you're talking about a magazine that had the likes of Oppenheimer and Einstein, and Popper himself may have written for it at one point, I haven't checked, that wrote some really good pieces that were really about science and meant for the layperson at the same time. And now it's writing drivel like that all the time. That's why Scientific American is something I laugh at nowadays.
It's a blog like everything else now. Like, they're getting a piece of the pie. I mean, to some extent, it's because media has never really been particularly profitable unless you count movies and pop music. But the news business was never really that viable. It was either bankrolled by a wealthy person, aka Pulitzer and Hearst. And then today's media is bankrolled by production studios. So they're really ads for ads. And actually, I met somebody recently who was a communications graduate student for a short time before she went into her current career. And she said the first day of class, they wrote on the board, news equals entertainment. So it's not even a secret. And a lot of people think news is for learning these days because you can just Google something and find an article. It's probably on a news site. It probably uses verification principles. It's probably telling you a bunch of true things that sum to a very not true thing in the end. And you're not learning. You're being turned into an ideologue based on whatever the bias of that particular publication is. All journalism is susceptible to it, so I'm not surprised that Scientific American fell down the same slippery slope as the rest of them. Mm-hmm. So, yes, rant over until later when I do it again.
But all of that is ideologically driven, though, and that's the thing that we see with postmodernism, is they're not interested in what the truth is. And the other thing for us is for things like journalism and science, which is supposed to be reality-based community and highly interested in what the truth is. Yeah. That becomes a problem when you have a whole bunch of folks that are either trained as ideologues or they just folks are bringing in ideology all the time. And so that's where we get into the serious problem. I mean, it's the extreme that I hope we never see, but that's where Lysenkoism becomes reality again. Because that's what that's the reason it's gets named Lysenkoism, is it's ideology over truth seeking. Always when you're talking about Lysenkoism.
And they have this, he has this great quote at the end of the paper in the conclusion. It's a Bertrand Russell quote. When any limits are placed consciously or unconsciously upon the pursuit of truth, philosophy and science, note by the author, becomes paralyzed by fear, and the ground is prepared for a government censorship punishing those who utter dangerous thoughts. In fact, the philosopher scientist, note by author, has already placed such censorship over his own investigations. And then he says, more than 50 years after these sentences were written, these fears have again become reality. I do genuinely hope, and this is my hope, that all of us that are panicking about this, that in 10 or 20 years, we look back and we go, oh, wasn't that funny? We were so worried about that, but it didn't end up materializing the way we thought. Thank goodness. That's what I wish. I hope that I can look, I hope I can look back on this and chuckle at how much the internet made us panic. But
well,
I don't know what will happen. I do hope that we're wrong, because it is, I mean, these are very alarming claims. Like, if you really take these claims seriously, this is like, you know, this will touch every aspect of modern life, and it's very frightening if you really let your head wrap around the reality of what happens when the one place that we count on to acquire knowledge, you know, independent of ideology, is now ideology. Like, it gives you whiplash, honestly, where you just look back on the past and you're like, how the hell did this happen? I was just like growing up in this world thinking that, like, you know, everything made sense. And I don't know. It's just a little bit of an emotional take on this, but I'm saying, like, it, you know, I hope we're wrong. I hope that Bertrand Russell is not, I hope that doesn't make sense someday.
I hope so too. And I mean, I hope for a lot of things that we don't have to worry and be concerned about all of that. And, you know, but you're right. We rely on scientific research for so many things, be it, you know, tech or cancer treatments or infrastructure or any number of different things. And when it's ideologically driven, well, then the truth doesn't matter. Then, well, you know, you have bridges that fall apart and you have other things.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Lysenkoism, we've had this happen in history before. Lysenkoism is a real thing. When ideology, regardless of what kind of ideology, trumps the pursuit of the truth in a reality-based community, it is all sorts of bad things.
Yeah.
History has shown that many times over, and we don't need to repeat that right now. But speaking
of, on a positive note, before you do your thing, on a positive note, because I always like to end this way, there's a lot more people today talking about preserving rationality than probably there was when the Soviet Union was establishing itself. We know a lot more science now than we did then, and I would like to believe that we're wise enough now not to let it get to the point of famine and structural collapse. I want to believe that we know more. And the benefit of the internet is that you and I and people like us can get together and have public conversations where we say exactly, you know, where we name the problem and discuss it openly. That may have not been possible. It was not possible because the internet didn't exist back then, and it was really hard to talk about these things and have kind of like this collective appreciation for rationality. The ideologues use the internet to further their ideas, but we can do the same thing. So
we can do that. And to get us off on a happy note also, again, if you want to have some fun times with fun people who are, you know, building culture and better things back here. Like I said, wokescreen.com/culture-warriors, promo code Shia Sophia. You get 10% off and a little bit comes back to me to help the channel and make things grow over here. So that would be appreciated if you go over there and become a member at any level. It, like I said, is all sorts of fun on the back end, you know, because we have our private Discord where we get into fun conversations and share memes, and there's great recipes that get shared and artistic stuff as well as news bits and just general conversation. Games night is also a blast. We do that quite twice a week. Actually, we do that twice a week, gaming. Plus a behind the Discord wall gaming night, so you're on top of it, because we all seem to like games in the group right now. It's kind of fun. Cool. Those kinds of things. So if you want a respite from a world gone crazy, I highly recommend wokescreen.com/culture-warriors. Again, code Shia Sophia for 10% off. So I will put that away. I don't have anything else to add. Overall, I think it was a good article. I think it was closer on the apple pie order kind of spectrum.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with some ice cream on top, I'd say.
Ooh,
yeah.
Yummy.
Yeah. Well, now I'm hungry. All right, well, go have some apple. Yeah, go have some apple pie, everyone, and stay curious.
Yes, stay curious, everybody. Thanks for watching this episode of the Rogue Journal Club. If you would like to suggest ideas for the show, please consider becoming a supporter of Wokescreen at wokescreen.com/culture-warriors. Use promo code Shia Sophia for 10% off your membership. The Rogue Journal Club is a Shia Sophia production, copyright 2024.